Welcome to Post-Status Draft, the official podcast for Post-Status, a website with news and information for WordPress professionals. Today, I'm talking with a special guest, Jay Hoffman, who is going to discuss a project that he's been working on the history of the web, and we're going to talk about WordPress's 15th birthday as well. If you enjoy this podcast, you can get more quality news and analysis from the Post-Status Club. Go to our website at poststatus.com/club to check it out, and you will be able to stay on top of what's happening in the WordPress space. Today, I'd like to feature one of our partners, WooCommerce. WooCommerce is the top e-commerce platform in the world. They, I think, power over 40% of all e-commerce websites now, and they are always releasing new and interesting stuff for their product. Go to WooCommerce.com to learn more about them, and thank you to the WooCommerce team for being a Post-Status partner. Now, here's our show. Hey, Jay.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So like I said in the intro, Jay Hoffman, you work at Reactive. I didn't mention that. So Reactive Studios is a, how would y'all define your company?
Yeah, we're a small development shop. We're a featured VIP partner. So we work on sort of larger enterprise projects, higher ed projects, things like that. But we like to keep things, small and focused on the client.
Okay. So you're maybe like a high-end boutique shop almost?
I think that would be an accurate description. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And y'all have been a VIP partner for several years now, right?
Yeah. It's gone back for a while. And we've worked very closely with Automatic and the VIP team over the years to just, ensure that all of our clients have super high quality code, and performance and security is super important on the platform, which is ideals that, that we share. So,
and you're a lead developer at Reactive?
Yeah, lead developer. There's a team of about five developers and, full team of only about seven.
Okay. And where were you before that to get into a role like that?
Yeah. So, I started my web career, I guess, or professionally, at Sesame Street, actually, which was Sesame Workshop, really, which is the company behind Sesame Street, which was a pretty incredible, first job out of college.
Is that a remote position or?
No. The offices, I'm in New York and the offices are in Manhattan. Okay. So I kind of started there on the marketing team, just working on a few things on their existing site, and ended up porting their main marketing site over to WordPress. And then over the years, continued to work with them and do more and more development. And then after that, spent about a little over a year at Penguin Random House, which is a publisher. Again, they're also based in New York, in Manhattan. And did even more work there and got a bunch of their sites up, blog sites and news sites that they run, again, on WordPress. And then I found myself at Reactive about a year and a half ago, and it's been great. It's been definitely the best team that I've worked on so far.
Was your experience, I guess Sesame Street's a publisher of sorts, but big media in a way. So mm-hmm. Did it feel like that when you were there, or did it feel?
I was there during a really incredible time. And looking back, it was kind of crazy. It's one of the longest running media brands of all time.
Yeah, they've been on for 50 or 60 years, something like
that.
Yeah,
it's close to 50 now. When I was there, a new CEO stepped in, who is the current CEO, and right as I was leaving, they sold some of the licensing rights to HBO, which is now mm-hmm. screens on both PBS and HBO. It was a major step for the company, and it allowed them to continue to this day. I mean, running a nonprofit media company is mostly unheard of. And running it for that long is there's just no other company that's done it. So it's just filled to the brim with these creative people. And you never end up doing just one thing. You're always running around. I think people say that about nonprofits, and it's definitely true there.
Did it feel like a nonprofit with the way that the company operates?
And I worked with the Sesame Workshop side of things, which really is the nonprofit. So yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with outreach and, you know, education around the world. And it's not just in the US. So they're really devoted to like a core mission there. It's a really interesting place to work. It's a really interesting place to have been sort of a part of.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, my oldest son, Sesame Street was his first TV show and his only TV show that he watched for the first 6 or 8 months that we allowed
him
to watch TV.
That's smart.
So he'd get like, we'd let him watch like one episode of Sesame Street a day, and like we'd watch half of it in the morning and half of it in the afternoon or something like that. Yeah. And that would be his TV, and it was really, really great. So it's interesting to hear a little bit about how the organization works.
Oh yeah. I mean, I learned a lot about just like how important those first few years of a kid's life are. There's a lot that can happen just developmentally. So it's kind of incredible. And
it's fascinating because now he's 3 or almost 3. And, you know, they pick up on a lot when they watch television, and you have to be careful because even very innocent television can have things that are difficult to understand for a child that young. So like from 18 months or however old he was when he watched his first TV until he's 3 years old, like, you know, there can be sensitive topics. So recently we've been watching like The Lion King is his thing, but The Lion King is full of like devastation. So like there's all this, there's death and hatred and these things, these concepts that are difficult for a young kid to explain. And that's a kid's movie.
No, I think back sometimes to the stuff that probably, you know, we watched when we were kids, and it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. And I would say The Lion King and some of those other projects like that, they're pretty cognizant of it as well, even if they're still a little bit, you know, more age appropriate for somebody his age. But Sesame Street was great because really it was education based, positive topics. And anyway, so it was a really cool show for us. And I wish he still would watch it more, but now he knows how much is out there in the land of television. Trying to keep him away from as much of it as possible.
Definitely.
Anyway, so what kind of WordPress stuff were you familiar with in your first positions relative to what you do with Reactive? Like, were they as high intensity in terms of the focus on code quality and security, or was it more trying to get the project done?
I think it's pretty much night and day from now to then. I think those days, it really was. It was like, let's get the projects up. Speed was essential. If you work for a large company, you'll probably find that to be true. So getting projects out as quickly as possible allows you to like sort of prove yourself, I guess, is a good way of saying it. So
when you say speed, you mean the speed of the project completion.
Yeah, exactly. Getting an idea out, at least a first version of it, is extremely important. I think my skills when I started were much more just about, you know, a lot of people when they first come to WordPress, for me, it was kind of a reintroduction to WordPress after a few years break. I started in high school and college and then took a few years away from development in general and kind of came back to it. So I was kind of getting familiar with it. These days I'm working on, you know, advanced API integrations and, you know, custom WordPress admin interfaces and just all sorts of much, much more advanced projects. And I was at Sesame, I was, the only developer on my team. There were other developers in the company, but I was the only one. So having a team now where, you know, every bit of code that we do now is intensely reviewed by other members of the team. And it's a much more rewarding process. But, when I was working back then, there was no alternative.
Yeah. I've always found that interesting that when people do things in-house, they tend to have much lower standards in terms of the deliverable and quality-wise. Maybe presentation, the standards are high, but like the back end is just not that important a lot of times.
That would be my point too. Yeah, I mean, I think especially for brands like that, like sort of big companies, it's the emphasis is always on, you know, how does it look and does it fit into the rest of the all the other products and projects that we're putting out into the world? And it really has to fit into that mold. So nobody's really examining, I guess, the back end so close.
And, it's not that they don't want it. It's just that they're not cognizant of it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why they bring in, you know, other shops to help with that.
And I was about to say, what's fascinating is that when consultants go in and pitch a project, code quality and testing and some of these things are of utmost importance in the pitch oftentimes.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I don't know how much you're doing that side of things, like customer facing, trying to talk to them about the importance of those things. But how do you get that point across that that is important when you're choosing a consultant, when clearly on the in-house side, it's often forgotten?
I've actually found it's fairly easy to convince a client of that, because you're coming to it from a sort of a position of expertise. So when you're in-house, it's just because of the way that structures are set up. A lot of times it's easier, to sort of ignore best practices, but you know, when you come and that's in our, you know, that's in our tagline, basically that's in our pitch is like, that's what we're going to do. So we very rarely have a hard time convincing clients of the importance of things like performance and security and testing. But it really just takes, like an outsider's perspective. It's a very interesting thing I think about just in-house teams in general. Like if you just come to it from the outside, people will listen to things that maybe they wouldn't have previously.
That's really funny. I don't understand why that is the case, but
yeah,
I believe it and I've seen it myself, but it's cool to hear it from your perspective.
Yeah.
So, let's dig in a little bit to how you got to even doing this side project. So to introduce this, you run a website called thehistoryoftheweb.com. Yep. So I take it you must be a history nerd of sorts, at least in terms of the web.
Yeah. History nerd just in general. I studied in school. I wrote a few research papers, did a few like very large scale research projects. Considered academia for a brief period of time before I thankfully chose a different path. Not that that isn't rewarding, but it is a frustrating field for sure. So this is, I think, history of the web for me, and just a brief description of it. Basically, each week I dive into sort of a different facet of the history of the web. So, I mean, it really ranges from the development of programming languages and software to the creation of standards to, you know, browser development over the years. And I have a newsletter. So, send out just a new story every week. And in so doing, I've also been building up a timeline, of as many events from the history of the web as possible. So each week as I add a story, I also add a few more things to the timeline. The idea being that me and the audience and the people that have been reading along can kind of build up this history together. And it's been really, really just fun and encouraging. Go ahead.
When you build the timeline, so if you go to the website, it's broken out to where you can browse. Yep. Browse the time, or you can go to the timeline page and you can browse based on things that happen in a particular year, like a timeline. When you do this, are you filling it in through all sorts of dates, or have you mostly tried to stick to like, we're going to cover what happened in 1990 and now 1991?
So that was like a huge decision at the beginning. I was like, do I want to try to step through this date year by year, or do I just kind of want to come into it? What I decided was the latter. So basically, because it's impossible to know if I'm going to have to come back to a certain year. So I can't ever really say like 1991 is done, you know? Right.
Cause like for all I know, story.
Exactly. Exactly. So I decided like, this is going to be more of like a research project that other people are peering in on essentially. And, I'm basically sharing my findings with people every week. So they're discovering as I'm discovering, but that really means that at any given time, I've done stories from the last couple of years all the way back to 1989 when everything got started.
That's awesome. So what are a couple of the things that you've been surprised by doing this project? Because you're obviously a student of the web, but you have to have come by a lot of new and interesting things doing this.
There's been quite a lot. I think the most surprising thing to me has been, and you hear, if you hear interviews with people that have been on the web for a long time, they'll say this all the time. Just about every discussion we're having these days on the web has happened before, and it's happened in the recent past. It's not even like it happened 100 years ago. Like, you know, obviously the web's only 25 years old. So a little older than that, but so the same kind of conversations that are happening today, let's say around JavaScript development, right? Like whether or not a site should load without JavaScript at all. Well, we've had that discussion a bunch of times when standards first became a thing in the 90s. That was a discussion. When progressive enhancement was discussed, that was a conversation. So these things keep coming back and back around. And for some reason, our memory on it is incredibly short. So that's been something that's definitely been sort of eye-opening for me.
Why do you think our memory is so short on these types of topics? Because, I mean, I know technology is moving quickly in terms of the way we're developing various frameworks and whatnot, but like you said, it's not like some of these things were that long ago. Like there were a lot, like you mentioned JavaScript, you know, a site loading with or without JavaScript. I remember maybe Twitter or somebody like that. They did a thing where they essentially got rid of permalinks and they had the hashtag in the URLs so that it would mm-hmm. not change yep. the URL if you click a page. So it made it difficult to archive a lot of that web, and that was taken and used on all sorts of other websites. And then if you didn't have JavaScript enabled, nothing would show up on the page. Like that was several years ago. And then yeah. we kind of all agreed like that was a bad idea. And yep. now you're saying we're going through these same discussions again with yeah. new frameworks. So like node-based stuff, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. There's probably a few reasons. I think one of the most interesting shifts that I've been kind of trying to hone in on lately is I really feel like, and the dot-com crash sort of frames the shift, but there was this shift in the let's say late 90s and into the early 2000s, where web development became this practice that was just done by like single webmasters working alone in like universities and companies, and they were kind of like wizards and people would just hand them what they wanted and they would make it happen. And then all of a sudden it became like this, oh, you can make millions of dollars on websites. And it kind of took over every industry. And obviously that continues to be true. And I think that brought in new perspectives, which has been really good. But it also, that's part of where the memory loss I think comes from, is because all of a sudden, you know, the web was injected with this brand new spirit and in a lot of ways, a brand new purpose, which was much more focused on, let's say, creating businesses and creating value for users and things like that. And not so much development of the technology itself and just kind of geeking out. So I think some of it is from that, and it continues to be true today that every few years, I mean, there's thousands and thousands of developers that are getting in that really don't have that historical perspective. So even a perspective of a few years ago, because they weren't even kind of working in it yet. And there's very few resources I find like mine that are kind of talking about it. So how would you kind of even know? You know, there's lots of different reasons. And then, you know, there's the pace of advancement on the technologies on the web. I mean, we're constantly reexamining our best practices. Sometimes it's the right thing to do and say, wait a minute, like we've been doing things this way for so long. Maybe it is time for a change, or maybe we can be doing something differently. And sometimes we're just, you know, going back and reinventing the wheel for no reason. So kind of have it both ways.
How do you decide when something's ready for archival in a sense. So one example I've pulled up on your website is the decade long path to web fonts was an article that that you wrote. And obviously you waited to write this until web fonts had been on the web for a very long time. And you created a post that, you know, discusses this at length. So how do you decide, like, this post is ready to be written now and we can put this on the timeline?
They're gut calls at the moment. It's interesting because already when I started, basically everything I could think of or find was archival ready, right? Because it was all happening in the past. But since I've started, there's actually been like new things that have both risen and sort of solidified themselves. And I started about a year and a half ago, maybe to almost 2 years ago. So for instance, something I've been like itching to write about is CSS Grid. I really feel like that's a fascinating story and it really connects into a lot of other stories on the web. Not quite there yet on it. You know, it's still kind of in flux. It's still not like the story isn't complete, let's say. So another one is my most recent story is about Flash. And obviously Flash is come and gone and all that. But I wrote about it very shortly after Adobe announced that they were no longer going to be supporting it. So to me, that felt like, okay, we can close the door on this story. It has some sort of finality to it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense because it's they made it. So therefore, it's probably right. Time for that one.
Right.
You built the website in a way where you have articles and then you have short items on the timeline. How do those relate to one another? So like, do you write an article and then you kind of tag timeline events that are related to that?
That's exactly right. So each main story will have several timeline events tagged to it, and then I try to fit the story into the timeline in a place that sort of makes sense, so that as you're browsing the timeline, you can go and explore these stories, which sort of connect up. But yeah, each story will usually have 2, 3, sometimes 4 timeline events attached from them that I'm basically able to extract from the story. And again, it's all part of kind of making the readers part of my research process was the general idea behind a good amount of these decisions.
Have you found instances where people discover something that you did and like write to you or something, either that they had some revelation or maybe they were involved in something or anything like that?
I actively encouraged that and I've gotten quite a few. I've gotten contacted by people that work at the W3C. I've gotten contacted by, you know, developers that have worked with the web since like the very beginning, all the way up to like new developers that are like, oh, I never realized this, you know, and have a few questions, which I'm definitely always happy to answer. There's been more than a few stories that have come from readers and not from me.
That's cool.
Yeah.
What about in terms of how this affects your day to day? So like, do you think of your job and the work you're doing? Cause you're writing code, you know?
Yep.
Do you think of it in the terms of like, how will we see this in a historical time frame? Like how would I look upon this project 10 years from now?
I've always kind of thought about things like that again, cause like my background is history. So I'm always kind of, I've been interested in a project like this. Like I've been doing it for 2 years. I've been interested in it for 6 or 7 and I've been thinking about it since college, you know? So, I'm kind of always thinking about that. It does actually help make decisions. If you make decisions that, you know, have some history to it and have some perspective on it, it can help you make the right call when you're trying to, let's say, choose a framework or decide whether or not your site's going to run without JavaScript. Or, you know, so all these decisions that go into day-to-day development can be informed by the web's history. And I think I've heard from a few readers, at least, that that's been true in their own work.
Yeah, I've never been like an active participant in that type of thought, but I do whenever, like, say I'm designing, hey, I want something to look a certain way. I try to think when I'm doing it, like, is this design element, especially design elements more than code, but like, is this a fad that I'm just participating in? Right. And like, or is this the type of thing that can last several years from now? And now that I'm running a website where it's not client work that for me disappears in 6 months or whatever, yeah. It makes a big difference in the way I approach something, like whether it's a tool I'm using, like, so I've decided to use some plugin or, you know, a code framework within a project, or if I'm making a design decision about how I want something to look, I really want to make something that one fits within the website itself, but also that I would hopefully won't feel compelled that I have to like completely rip it apart 12 months from now because yeah. it's some particular fad.
Which is almost impossible to avoid in the decisions we make, you know, yeah. thinking about it certainly helps a little bit.
Every yeah. now and then, though, there's one where I'm like, no, like, this is clearly the type of thing that I'm going to hate in the future, even if it appeals to me in some way or another right now.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it took me a long time to come over to, like, let's say the React train, which has been going strong for a few years now.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. That was actually what sure. I wanted to ask you about next, is because that's an example where it's probably not ready to write about it, certainly in a historical sense. But
no.
in terms of the current, that is where the development flow is right now. Like, it's hard to even see JavaScript be discussed without JavaScript frameworks that are a whole new layer. It's not JavaScript really, it's like React is its entire massive ecosystem and is responsible for a great deal of the foundations of web development right now. So how do you approach something like that where you know this will be a topic in the future, but that story's it's probably not there yet in terms of start to dig into it yet. How are you approaching it?
Well, I would say one of my thoughts, or let's say fears, about React is that I really do feel like people consider it done. But if you look at it in terms of historical perspective, you would realize that no, we're not done. There's like a lot that needs to be shaked out still with React. I think one day we will get to a point where when you approach a React project, things like server-side rendering, which make obviously things load faster and are a little bit better for users, things like progressive web apps, PWAs, like these kinds of things will be built right into the platform. I mean, these are concepts that are kind of coming together from a lot of different parts of the web. And I think where libraries like React, and it's not just React, Vue is obviously playing a very big role there as well, as a few others. But libraries like that are going to be more complete, I would hope, in the future. So I think we're so focused right now sometimes on these like micro optimizations inside of React, like, you know, how can we shave a few bytes off, or how can we inject our CSS into our JavaScript, which I won't go into too much, but that's a whole other episode. You know, we're so focused on these things that we're not seeing that there, I think there's still a larger picture to be complete with it. So I work with React quite a bit, and I think it's very rewarding to work with, and it solves a lot of use cases that didn't even exist a few years ago. So to me, that part makes sense. This is all part of the development of the web. But some of its decisions seem to be focused on really just like these narrow decisions rather than these larger big picture decisions.
Yeah. Have you been able to identify things where you see they'll have consequences? Like, one of the things I noticed with React is because I'm not developing every day.
Yep.
So when I dig into something, it's like, wow, there's been a whole lot of change
yep.
in this framework. And with React, it's often breaking change. Mm-hmm. And have you been able to say, like, I've seen this story before because I've done a lot of research on past technology iteration, you know, processes, and say, like, man, this is not going to go well, or like there's going to be consequences that people may not be seeing in the future.
There's a lot. Yeah, I think all this is, you know, to bring it to WordPress for a second, one of the interesting things about future versions of WordPress is that React is going to be bundled in, which is great. But what does that mean for your custom development build? So are you including your own versions of React? Are you using WordPress's versions of React, which is always, always, always going to be a few versions behind? You know, I don't think that React is built to exist in a world like that necessarily. And it doesn't seem, I've seen a few people bring it up, but it's not something that I think is being actively discussed. So things like that make me fearful when I think this weird thing happens where we just assume a technology is ubiquitous. We assume that it's inevitable. And then we assume that it's just, you know, it's going to be used everywhere. And okay, everybody uses React now. And my work with the history of it all is like, whoa, slow down. Like, these things change. And we don't have to like 100% commit to things, you know, before getting the full picture.
Yeah, that makes sense. Before we dig into the WordPress side of things and WordPress's sure. 15th birthday, I do want to take a brief break to thank our partner for the episode, which is WooCommerce. I hope everybody knows about WooCommerce and maybe has used it. Jay, do you ever use WooCommerce in your work
Certainly
side
used
of things?
It. It's a great product.
Yeah, so WooCommerce itself has been around for quite a while now. I think maybe 6 or 7 years. And they've really tackled adoption on, the long tail of the web, similar to the way WordPress did, where if you need a small shop, you can get going with WooCommerce. And then what we've seen over the years is people's small shops become big shops, or people who have decided they want to use WooCommerce because it matches the rest of their platform and they're using WordPress for e-commerce, which is an avenue that I don't think we would have expected 15 years ago for WordPress to be used so thoroughly for today, which is e-commerce. And WooCommerce just had version 3.4 release, which includes a lot of stuff, including compatibility with the GDPR regulations that have been the rage and the the focus of your email inbox probably for all the privacy policy adjustments for every service that you're signed into. But they also have a lot of new features for store owners, as well as people that build and develop with WooCommerce. Check out WooCommerce at WooCommerce.com. And thank you to the WooCommerce team for being a PostStatus partner. We greatly appreciate it. And I run my businesses using WooCommerce, so I'm thankful that it is there and they do a great job. So Jay, let's dig into the WordPress side of things. You hinted at we're going on 15 years. May 27th is WordPress's yep. 15th birthday. So happy birthday, WordPress. When you talk about the potential implications with WordPress, I can think of a couple of things where maybe this has happened in the past, but what comes to mind for you in terms of if we're not careful about like how we think of the future when bundling something like React into the platform?
With WordPress specifically, there's a few things that come to mind. I think ultimately WordPress has always lagged behind a bit. I mean, that's been true since the earliest days of the platform, and it continues to be true today that it lags behind the newest trends just a bit. And that's been, I think, a strength and a weakness. It's allowed WordPress to kind of angle itself and kind of make much slower but deliberate decisions about its future. So what I'm seeing a little bit with what's going on right now is that some of those decisions to me seem a bit rushed, especially about the inclusion of frameworks like React. But I think that the core team has recognized that the pace of development, especially JavaScript development, is increasing. And so there's nothing to say that their decisions now are permanent. And I think that they've recognized that, and that React has been kind of a starting point for them. And that, you know, the platform may continue to run on it, but they're always ready to sort of to reconfigure that if necessary. And they've made some really smart decisions about abstracting, you know, React away to make that possible in the future.
Yeah, I think one of the things that everybody that's been involved in the WordPress landscape for a long time realizes is that even though sometimes that lag of the most modern technology, like you mentioned, can be frustrating, in your custom work, you can always use newer stuff because WordPress supports you to do quite a bit on your own, however you like. But also it's, I think it's probably, been a huge factor in WordPress's success just because a lot of times those breaking changes are less necessary if you wait until a lot of the questions and uncertainty are ironed out of the package or whatever it is that you're including or whatever you're doing, like a route you're following in development style. It truly does become a standard because it's been several years of that thing being used or worked on. And, you know, that has at times been a frustration, especially for developers that always want to be on the cutting edge. But I think it's been just a massive benefit for WordPress in on the user side, in the website owner side, because for the most part, even with like the biggest plugins in WordPress, you can update it once the updates are there and like not break everything. And I would bet if I built something fully with, you know, a new CMS, especially if it's like a, say some fully JavaScript framework thing, you know, everything's in brand new JavaScript and it, you just wouldn't get that. Like if you just tried to go update everything, you would have a week's worth of development just trying to get reach compatibility. So the fact that the process has been so deliberate for WordPress has really made it an incredibly reliable platform so that it can survive for 15 years. And maybe we're a year or two behind the most modern thing all the time, but I think on the whole, that's been a beneficial thing for WordPress to be conservative.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I mean, I think, you know, when WordPress was built, it was 2003. And Mozilla had actually just come out. And Mozilla was a 3.5 year rewrite. It was a rewrite of Netscape, which was the Netscape Navigator, which was the browser that came before it. It took a long time. The rendering engine inside of it was rewritten 3 times. And that was going on with a lot of different projects on the web. So I think when Matt and Mike started it up, they vowed basically to never allow that to happen. And it's funny because it goes against most decisions that have been made in software projects since and to this day. Like a lot of times, you know, the instinct is to rewrite. And that happens all the time. And WordPress has always resisted that. And it's been, I think, you know, an extremely fortuitous decision for WordPress because, I mean, you know, it's lasted this long. It's grown to, what are we even up to now? 28% of the web?
Yeah, 27-28% of the web, something like that. And, you know, you can, there's a clear version of doing the opposite of that. And I think Drupal is a great platform for its own use cases, but like, in the time that WordPress did its thing, from version whatever it was back when Drupal 6 was out, you know, pre 3.0, there's a Drupal 6 ecosystem, Drupal 7 ecosystem, Drupal 8 ecosystem, and they're basically entirely different CMSs, and the upgrade paths are not clear. And they're great in their own way. Like they work well and they do nice things, but at the end of the day, a Drupal 6 website is very difficult to become a Drupal 8 website. And the tools and the things that are required are a great challenge for the people building on that. Whereas a WordPress, you know, 2.7 website can be a WordPress 4.9 website or whatever. And to me, that the focus on that transferability and upgradability with WordPress has just been incredibly important. When you wrote your article about the story of WordPress, you mostly focused on the early days of the project. Are there any things that you noticed when you were just kind of researching the early years of WordPress that you feel like were pivotal to WordPress's success, but maybe weren't weren't thought of as like some, this is why this project will be important in the future type of moments?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about the early history and I think continues to be true today is that, again, like WordPress has always made these kind of slow decisions. They've been first to the table with nothing. I mean, almost nothing over the years. But they've always made these like, they've always just kind of kept developing along with established best practices. So for instance, like Matt Mullenweg, when he got started with the project, one of the first things he did was to rewrite the template in order to like be compatible with the latest versions of what was at the time, it was called XHTML, but it's, for simplicity, it was basically the latest web standards. And they just kind of made these like very small decisions that grabbed a lot from movable type at the time. And movable type was the most popular blogging platform in 2003. And WordPress didn't even come close in its release. And then about a year after WordPress was released, movable type decided to start charging users quite a bit more for use of their platform, which was a business decision. But WordPress was just there. I mean, they didn't have to change a thing. They were already, they had these forums set up where people could like, you know, ask questions and get help setting their site up. They had IRC channel for developers to hop on, and they had like, they already had their really easy install, right? So, they were just ready. So when users were looking for an alternative, WordPress was there. And that's been true, I think again and again, each time. I think it happened with Tumblr. It's happened over the years quite a few times with WordPress, where they offer themselves as just an alternative that is steady and tested and all that. I mean, it happened, I think, most recently probably with Medium, when Medium decided to kind of, let's say, make things hostile for some of its partners. Again, WordPress was there, and it's just, oh, here's this alternative, and it's got everything we need.
Yeah. There are several decisions that I think were fully like Matt, essentially his vision applied to WordPress, and they were very deliberate. For instance, you know, the GPL licensing and the role that plays on the software, the creating the plugin ecosystem and the theme ecosystem, huge decisions that had long lasting impacts. One that I think was just such a pivotal decision that was cool to have at the time, but I don't think a lot of people necessarily looked at it like this is going to be a huge deal in the future. And I think it has been a huge deal, was introducing auto update capabilities. Mm-hmm. I think it was in 3.7 that the framework was laid to be able to do that. But introducing that, each version and every update that you have, it just adds this layer of stability to WordPress that now we're 12 major versions on, of being able to have that and being able to do things like patch vulnerabilities from the past. And I think one other platforms you mentioned, we didn't do anything first. I do think creating easy auto updates, one click updates on open source software was a big thing that WordPress spearheaded in a way, at least on the major CMSs. And then the other would be these auto updates, the willingness to not require the user to like instantiate these updates. And there was pushback on doing that. Like, I remember when auto updates was the debate. But I don't know that anybody really thought, or a lot of people thought strongly about like, this is going to be an impactful decision for the future. But when I look back, to me now, this is really important, because I think we could have reached a point where user frustration increased as they were unwilling to update, because WordPress was secure as updates came out, but like they were unwilling to update, and therefore they were using software that was vulnerable. And now we have this ability to essentially help users be less vulnerable to being hacked and other things that happen with open source software. And to me, that was probably one of the more low-key decisions that had one of the bigger impacts on the ecosystem.
That's really interesting. And I think it's also, it's helped users get familiar with the idea that updates happen and it's not going to affect your site. So WordPress has a really great update path for its user, like just or let's say percentage for users using the newest versions.
I don't think that would have worked if WordPress didn't have that philosophy of like, don't break things when, when people press update.
Yeah. Which I think was an extremely important decision. Again, a decision made early on by like a very small group of developers. And again, has been, I mean, it's just like one of the most, that and its GPL license were probably one of the two crucial early decisions. And they've kind of stayed with the software, you know, to now.
What do you think, based on studying other projects and just your experience in WordPress, you've been involved in the ecosystem for a long time now. If you think like, okay, 15 years from now, what WordPress will look like in another 15 years, do you think it'll look a lot, in a lot of ways, the same? Or do you think there's a need for iteration? Like, do we know what 30-year life cycles of software look like?
I think the only thing we know what a development cycle that long is programming languages and possibly some browsers that have at least history stretching back, like let's say longer than WordPress, but certainly not without some major rebranding or rewriting over the years. Yeah. So there's not many projects to compare it to. I think it's worth going back and taking a look at screenshots of WordPress from its first release, and then also HappyCog did a redesign of it in, can't remember the exact year, but in, you know, in the mid-2000s. So taking a look at those two and just recognizing how much actually has stayed the same in a really interesting way. So you mentioned plugins, which was it actually wasn't included in the first version of WordPress. Plugins were added about a year after its initial release. But those the way that those are kind of like added is different, but the UI of it is incredibly similar. And a lot of the different screens that you would look at, even the edit screen it harkens back to the early days. So I think if we flash forward 15 years, people will be surprised at how much stays the same in WordPress. But how much is different, like let's say behind the scenes, or even more importantly, what people are doing with it. So I think Matt continues to talk about like admin themes, and that would certainly change like a lot. But at the same time, I think when people do make admin themes, you know, we'll see a Wild West days, I think, where people do anything and everything with it. But eventually best practices will emerge and things will start to like sort of line up with let's say a WordPress way of doing things. And I think when we look back, we're going to say it's kind of incredible that a good amount of the way WordPress works is actually kind of stayed the same. And that's been a strength, I would say.
Yeah. I personally hope that the admin experience is significantly simpler. Mm-hmm. I think the earliest versions of WordPress, part of the reason people were so drawn to it was simplicity. And we've created a lack of simplicity over the years with a lot of feature development. And I think having some form of admin is going to be completely necessary, but it will be interesting how much we'll be able to make the back end look like the front end in the creation of content. And I think this whole strategy with both the Gutenberg editor and also the content blocks and some of these things that are part of the development thesis of WordPress going forward are super important in terms of achieving that. So it does seem like it's the general roadmap.
Yeah. I mean, and, all this history has its costs, you know, so it's still kind of straddling. It started as a blogging platform and it's still straddling that, I think, a bit. And I can't tell you how many client projects we set up where we don't even need posts. Right. So, I think there's still a lot that needs to be done. But I think the direction that they're taking right now, is really bold, and I think it's gonna be for the best.
What risks do you think there are in terms of how the development process has changed? So, you know, it used to be we have a major version every 3 to 4 months and you ship what's ready. And now there's a much more of a grand vision ship when this feature is ready type of outlook on what the major versions will be. Do you think there are risks there? And what would you advise in terms of being aware of with that type of strategy?
I think I actually don't see a whole lot of risk there. I think it was a good choice for the direction that the platform is taking. I think one of the things we can sort of learn from or continue to do is educate the community in the meantime about what's coming and make beta versions of things available to developers as early as possible. So I've been experimenting with Gutenberg for some time now. I actually have my first Gutenberg commit was a couple weeks ago.
Nice.
But the outreach there has been great, and I think people are already sort of reaching out and starting to write articles and tutorials about how to use it, how to develop with it. So allowing for that, so the feature release approach allows for that, and I think that's really important, and we should hold on to that. So with each new subsequent feature release, get people involved early and often. I mean, that's how open source software works. That's how we're going to figure out what the bugs are and what the use cases are. And it means we won't have to rush things out. And this, this 4.96 release proves that there's going to be times when you have to get pretty major things out, and that's just, you're going to have to just get those out. In the meantime, these features are given a chance to like fully mature and fully be understood by the community before they're released. I have no problem with that.
Cool. Well, Jay, I appreciate you being on. People can go to thehistoryoftheweb.com. Did I get that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
The history, very, very direct. Thehistoryoftheweb.com. The newsletter is something you should subscribe to. You get those stories. And then I just have enjoyed now and a couple times previously just browsing through this timeline and exploring some stuff that's happened in the past that I either forgot about or I enjoyed being able to check out, like, remembering something like CSS Zen Garden, for example. Yeah. It was one of my first introductions to, what you can do when you're building a website and the power of CSS just alone.
Yeah.
And then what, where else can people catch up with what you've got going on?
You can find me on Twitter. It's at @JJY_Hoffman. That's with two N's, but you can just go to my history of the website and, I'm linked up there. And I have a really old site that I don't maintain that I won't even mention.
We'll tell people to go to Reactive then.
Yeah. So go to Reactive Studios to check out what I'm doing with client work.
Awesome. And they're a great team too. So I'm glad to
see
that you're there and doing so well. Yeah. Yep. I'm a big fan of Reactive and everything that y'all have going on. And go to postatus.com to check more about Postatus, and you can see the show notes. I'll link up some of this stuff. And we will talk to y'all later. See you next time.
Bye.